Welcome to the Private Practice Made Perfect podcast with me, Kathy Love. I'm a business coach who helps allied health professionals run powerful and profitable businesses in the disability sector. Join me for cutting-edge interviews with leaders in the allied health and business fields, along with plenty of practical content that you can use to make your business practice perfect. Famous last words for today's podcast. Let's just start recording and see what happens. My guest today is Jeremy Stretton, the CEO of The Business Legal Lifecycle, which happens to be a marvellous book written by a very marvellous person. Jeremy, welcome.
Thanks, Kathy. Thanks for having me on.
Pleasure. Anything I can do to keep you warm in a chilly Brisbane winter.
Yeah, it's so cold today that we weren't able to wear shorts around. So
I know.
It's just terrible.
2021, just 21. Torture.
Yeah, torture.
So I am holding up your book, and last time you were on the podcast, I was waving your book around, but your book now has application to the US and the UK.
Yeah, so we're doing this in 2019, and in 2018, I released the UK edition of the book, and just recently, in the last month or so, I released the US edition of the book. So pretty exciting. It's been a lot of hard work to get to that stage, but it's worth it because we're expanding our presence into those other countries. My goal is to make legal advice accessible for all SMEs around the world and to change the way that people view lawyers. And this is my first step, is to get out there and write this book in as many countries as I can. Not every country, that would probably do my head in, but as many countries as I can and the big ones so that we can actually help people.
So, Jeremy, you're a lawyer and you have a law practice, but your practice specializes in support for small business owners. Tell us just a little bit about that bit of it.
Yeah. So I started my practice 8 years ago with my business partner. And when we started, everyone was saying to us, you've got a niche, you've got to specialize. And so we took that advice and we went and spoke to our clients. And when people were saying, you've got a niche, you've got to specialize, they were talking about being a corporate lawyer or a property lawyer or an IP lawyer or a resumption lawyer and finding that one area to act for. The feedback that we got from our clients was they didn't want that. They didn't like that idea. They liked having a trusted advisor, someone that they could come to on a regular basis. So we decided to act for a type of client, and that was small to medium-sized business owners, and help them through what has now developed into the life cycle of the business. I hadn't written this book back then. But since then, I've written the book, and we were helping business owners throughout the life cycle of their business in all their various facets to assist them to build better businesses. And that's worked really well in the 8 years that we've been in business.
So how did you draw together the model of the business legal life cycle?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And it really came out of frustration more than anything else, Kathy. I had two matters, and I won't go into all the details, but I had two matters that were really frustrating for me. So I had one where a business owner was a franchisor, they ran a franchise business, and if they just got legal help, they would have saved themselves from $650,000 worth of debt. And another one that two gentlemen were going into a property development. And again, if they had just gone and got legal advice, they could have saved themselves over $1 million of other people's money that they sunk and they lost. And I was really frustrated. And I was sitting in my office one day just thinking, there has to be a better way. And I spoke to these people and I said, why didn't you get advice? Why didn't you talk to a lawyer? And they said, it's too expensive. I don't like lawyers. And lawyers are there to solve problems when they arise. And I was really frustrated because lawyers should be proactive. We shouldn't be reactive. We should be helping people before problems arise, not just solving problems in the after they've occurred. And so at the time, I was doing some education with our good friend David Dugan about business cycles. And I went, there's got to be a legal cycle. So I sat down and I went through all the businesses, over 5,000 that I'd acted for over that stage, about 11, 12 years of being a lawyer. And I worked out when they did things properly, when they did things poorly, and I mapped out a life cycle. And I said, this is the life cycle of a business. And I went backwards and forwards with a few different people, and we debated it and we moved things around. And then we came up with the model of the 13 phases that we have today and that is applicable. Yeah, it's the same in the US and the UK. It's the lawyers that I've partnered with over there recognize that the law is very similar at that higher level and that conceptual level about what people need in their business.
Yeah, I'm continually intrigued why business owners don't have a lawyer on their team. It may not be that the lawyer's at all the team meetings and, you know, meeting every 2 weeks, but they don't have anyone to go to. And so they sweat out the stress. They sweat out the what-ifs of they try and make decisions and they think their documents are okay. You reckon it's just about price or is it, I don't know, what is it with the image or the brand of lawyers?
Well, yeah. I mean, it comes back to my, yeah, part of my big heritage goal is to change the way that people view lawyers. And that is around the fact that we are unapproachable. We talk in legalese. We make things more complicated than they need to be. And that, in my experience, frustrates people. It frustrates business owners and clients who feel like the lawyer thinks that they're better than them and that they feel like that they don't have a say and that, you know, that they're belittled. And I think that there's a big piece that we lawyers can do to actually change that way of the way that we're viewed and the way that we can actually interact with our clients.
Yeah, pretty awesome, awesome people, the ones I've come across as well, and always valued having one at the end of the phone quickly and easily, even after hours. My lawyer actually was our neighbour, and that made it very convenient for those teary evenings where I would just limp next door and kind of try and figure something out. In my first business, used lawyers very proactively in my private practice. We'd get all our contracts checked every year. I'd get a few tests and measures on, you know, other team-related issues or product-related things that might be coming up. I'd get them to review all my documents for leases. And it wasn't a matter of if, it was a matter of when. And, lawyer was part of my business planning, actually, the start, end of 1 year, start of the next. There was often wine involved, fair to say, but for him to have the oversight of where I wanted the business to track meant that he had a context whenever I needed to come back and get something done, often quite quickly.
Yeah, and I think that we've moved away from that. You know, we've become a transactional business, just responding to problems, and we need to get more on that advice piece because there's lots of excellent lawyers out there. There's lots of excellent lawyers with great ideas and lots of stuff that can actually help people, and we need to be a bit more proactive in helping our clients. And that's one of the reasons that I sat down and developed the life cycle and then wrote a book out of it.
Yeah. So in the show notes, we'll put all the details of the business legal life cycle, how to successfully navigate your way from startup to success. Now, you mentioned the 13 phases. How about you run us through those 13 phases? Is it like naming your 13 favorite children?
No. My two children are my favorite children. These are these are business. 3 through 15, you know.
Yeah.
So you start off with conception phase. So that's phase one. And that's basically before you have the idea of, or when you have the idea of the business. And the very first things you need to start doing in your business just to start that going. Then you go into phase two, which is startup. And this is probably the one, you know, I do a lot of interviews and sometimes I get asked the question about which is the most important phase. And I think this is the most important phase. And I actually give this away a lot in my, as a chapter for people to read. Mm. Because startup is all about getting your entities right, understanding why you should set up the correct business entities, getting your insurances in place, getting leases in place. It's about the real fundamentals, the basic blocks that you need to build a great business. And so, you know, phase two startup is really, really important for that. Phase three is initial clients. So after you start your business, you need to start getting some clients or customers. And this is about putting the right information and agreements in place so that you can properly engage with those clients. And you know, you and I have talked about this before with private practice clients, that you need to have a good agreement just in case something goes wrong. Have a contract in place, because one of the things that I've always found, especially with startup business owners, is that we get so busy in doing the work that we forget to put the right documentation in place. 5-6 years goes down the track and a problem occurs and you don't have any documentation and you're going from a handshake from 5 or 6 years ago that one person has one idea about what was said and the other person has another idea and nothing ever gels, amazingly, when that happens. Mm. So engaging clients properly is really, really important. Then phase
contracts with team, clinical and customer service team, and agreements with customers.
Yeah, well, the team more comes into phase four, but absolutely with customers. So phase four is bringing on employees, so building the team. And at that point, you definitely need to have contracts with your with team members.
Not ones you've borrowed from a friend or written yourself? Not those ones? Not so much?
No. It's scary how many of those that I see that have references to US law or UK law. Because people
wow. them off offline,
online, or off a there's plenty of great resources out there. However, they're very problematic because they refer to the incorrect law, and then they might say that I've read some that are governed by the laws of Massachusetts in the US, or
which is good if you're there, but
yeah, great if you're there. But when you're out in outback Queensland or in outback New South Wales or Victoria, it doesn't really apply. You're not really going to run off to the Massachusetts courts to enforce your contract, and then you've got nothing. So having those contracts in place is so important, and not getting them from a friend, not getting something that you found off the internet, even if it does reference Australia law, every state is different, and getting the right ones is really, really important.
And understanding it, because you've got to be able to speak it and negotiate on it and understand what the restraints are and... Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've got to be fluent.
Yeah, it's ignorance of the law is no excuse. It's something we learn in law school, and it's a maxim that is true. And ignorance of what's in your contract is no excuse just as well. And if your contract says something, you better know that it says that. And it's not that hard to read it. And if it's, most contracts these days should be written in sufficient plain English. We've gone away from the legalese nonsense that, I read in law school. And, it is a lot better. You need to read them. And just saying, I didn't read those contracts is not an excuse. It doesn't get you out of them. Even Facebook terms and conditions,
Are you the person that reads them?
I am,
You have to tell me what they say.
We don't have that long. I mean, this isn't a Joe Rogan podcast to go for three or four hours.
Okay.
But, reading your contracts, understanding them, both your supply contracts and your employee contracts, team members, just understanding them and reviewing them every now and then, because a great contract means you have a great relationship. A bad contract, it always ends in tears. It just always does. And things might go well for a year or two, but then it just ends in tears later on. So read the contracts, get them done properly, and you'll save yourself a lot of headaches in the future.
Yep.
So that's phase three and four. Phase five is protecting intellectual property. And this is so you've got a business, you've got some clients, you've got some employees, you've got some team members, and now it's time to actually protect your intellectual property. And the reason for not doing it earlier is that I've seen far too often when people and business owners spend thousands of dollars, say, in the startup phase and protecting their intellectual property, and then they go and change it. They might go and get a trademark their business, and then it doesn't work in the marketplace, or they have another great idea, or some employees come along and they want to change the name. I don't think you should spend the money early on, unless you've got the next Google or the next Facebook. We all think we've got that, but unless you actually do, don't spend the money then. Build a model first, and then protect your intellectual property. It costs a lot of money, but once it's done right, it can really protect you going forward. So build some clients, build a team, and then build and then protect your intellectual property once you actually have something to protect. It's getting harder and harder. In 2019, when I first started this back in 2013, it was really easy to get a trademark because Google didn't really exist back then. Now, it's very, very difficult to get a trademark because the first thing that they do in the IP office is they Google a trademark, the name. And if there's any other business that's out there, then you have to justify why you should have the registered trademark over that business. And why to stop them from trading? So, but do it once you've proven your business model and got some clients is really about the intellectual property. Intellectual property is also about getting your systems and procedures in place, because you're building an asset to sell. And I'll get to phase 11, which is sale of the business later. Phase five is about building that intellectual property because that at the end of the day is your asset. And at some point in time, and I'll talk about this in a bit, but at some point in time you're going to exit your business. Whether it's by choice or some other arrangement that is completely unforeseen. I heard a podcast of a gentleman that I'm in a mastermind with, where his interviewee called it the bus factor. So what's your bus factor? As in being hit by a bus. Yeah.
Pleasant.
Yep. Pleasant. But I thought, isn't that a great way of making it real? And it really is the truth. So building that intellectual property just builds that business asset. So that's intellectual property. Did you have anything that you wanted to
ask? Tons more, but we can come back to it. Okay. Let's keep going on with the other okay. ones.
So phase six is maximizing your business and bringing in investors. So this is really all about, once you've got that intellectual property in place, now let's solidify what you've got and build your business to its maximum. Now, that doesn't mean, you know, the old factory days of working, you know, people from 7 to 8 o'clock at night and maximizing business that way. It's about getting to the maximum thing that you can do in your business the way that it is at that time and maximizing whatever you have there. And in this day and age, it's not about working everyone to the bone and having video cameras up and monitoring everyone. That just doesn't work. I still hear horror stories about that from clients. Excuse me. It's about maximizing what you've got and getting the maximum return for you. And also at that stage, looking at investors. So once you've protected all that stuff, all the intellectual property, got your employment agreements in place, then you're attractive for an investor. An investor might look and go, I could invest $100,000 in this business. You don't have to do that. You don't have to get an investor, but you don't want to do it until you get to phase six, because the value that they're getting will be minimized unless you have all that stuff in place.
And nor do you want an opportunity presented that you've just got a year's worth of work to do to get ready to sign.
Yeah. One of the things that I say in the book, I see this time and time again, even, you know, 3 or 4 years after writing the book, is that when you want to bring in an investor or you want to sell the business, generally you are 2 years away from doing that from when you just make the decision to do it, unless you follow the steps in the life cycle. And the reason for that is there's so many little things that you need to get right to maximize your return, whether that be for investors or for sale of the business. And and what that causes is then 2 years of angst. And if you do get to that, let's not even talk about the bus factor. If you just get sick, it can be very hard for you to do that in 2 years. And I unfortunately see that time and time again. So this is about putting those chocks into place. So that's phase six. Phase seven is about expansion. And that's very deliberately after you maximize your business. Because if you expand before you've done all those first six phases, problems will multiply. And any problems that you've got will multiply and multiply and multiply and multiply. And expansion can include franchising. So you could choose to franchise your business. You could choose to license your intellectual property. Or you could choose to buy another business. So that's the expansion phases can include all those things to expand your business, or even just to open up a second office or a second business premises. That's expansion too. But even, you know, I've done this from personal experience. My law firm, we have two offices. That was four. Two.
Yay.
two offices. And and when we opened the second office, this was before, yeah, I really thought about all this stuff, and the problems multiplied, and it was really a good lesson for us in not expanding too quickly. And I always say that to my clients, before you expand, make sure you solidify everything, get everything in place first, so that you don't multiply those problems into the future. So after you look at expansion, then we have estate planning, which is phase eight. This is something that a lot of lawyers and a lot of consultants will say to do a lot earlier. What I've recognized in the life cycle is that people don't like thinking about their estate planning. We don't want to think about what's going to happen when we're going to die. We don't want to think about what's going to happen if something happens to us that we don't want to, but it will happen at some point, and you need to have some plan in place to protect your family. So I put it in at phase eight, because if you haven't done it by now, you have to do it now. On this stage, you've protected, you've got clients, you've got employees potentially, or you've protected your intellectual property, and you've maximized your business, and you looked at expansion. You now have something to protect, and if it's not for you, for your family. And it's not a pleasant thing to have to think about, but it's something that you have to do at that phase.
And in the right hands, it's quite an interesting process as well.
Some people find it interesting, and I think it can be an interesting phase, and I think you've just got to go to it with the right mindset. A lot of people just don't like thinking about it, and I like to call that out and say, yeah, it's going to happen, so you need to think about it. And you really, what the big thing is, it's your legacy. You should decide what happens to it, and you don't want to leave your family in the lurch. So I think that's, for me, that's the big reason that you should get that done. So phase nine is investing in property. It could equally just be called investing, but lawyers only really get involved in investing in property. It could be investing in shares. It could be investing in other investments. And really investing in property is about, okay, so now you've got the business, you've done your estate planning. Let's now invest in your other businesses, in an investment business. You know, what is that business going to help you to retire early, or to not have to worry so much about where your income is going to come from? Invest your money. And again, you could do that earlier, But what I've found is that you're better off investing in your business up until phase nine. And then at that stage, when you've got some real equity and profits, then you can invest in property. And if you haven't done it by now, then you've really got to do it at that stage. Phase 10 is litigation and dispute resolution. And this is really, again, this could happen earlier in the business. It's really just calling out the fact that when you build a successful business, you're going to, at some point, there's going to be a dispute. There's going to be a dispute with someone, whether you like it or not, these things happen. Even if you have the greatest business in the world and you're the nicest person in the world, at some point, someone will take issue with you. And it's about calling it out and saying, okay, it happens often when businesses have all this in place and people see that there's something that they can actually attack, when they see that there's something that they can actually go after. And so litigation, dispute resolution, again, it's not pretty. It's something that we have to talk about though, because you need to understand that it does happen. And if you've put all the other steps in place, you should be protected very well going forward, but it does happen. So that's why we put it in at phase 10. I thought about putting it in earlier, but I thought phase 10 was appropriate because the really successful businesses, they put all that stuff in place and then they are protected in phase 10 and it really helps them to move forward and resolve any disputes quickly. So phase 11 is actually the top of the life cycle and it's the sale of the business, or the whole or part of the business, or bringing in investors. And this is really the goal of the business legal life cycle, is to build that business asset to sale. As I said before, at some point you're going to exit your business, whether it be by choice, by the bus factor, or by something else. You're going to exit your business. And it's 2 years from when you make that decision for the average business owner to be ready. So don't let that happen to you. Let's put all this stuff in place to get you ready for the sale of the business. And the reason it's at the top is because that's when we want the business at its maximum. That's where we want it to be maximizing its returns. So really that's you know, the best benefit and the best sale position for a business is when they get to phase 11. Then when you get through phase 11, then there's a choice. You can either go back to phase one and start another business, which a lot of people do, or you can...
I don't know any of those people.
No, none of them. I know none of them either. And then, or you could go to phase 12, which is retirement. So this is if you actually decide to retire. One of my mentors has retired. I think he's on his seventh time of retirement. So I think those of us who love businesses probably don't ever actually retire. But retirement is about having the right procedures in place to retire. In that, I also talk about buyouts, often in a professional services business, like a practice. The buyer might want you to do some sort of earn out in the business and they might want you to work for some period of time. So that's included in retirement. And in that, in the book, I talk about the fact that you need to structure that right and have the right goals in place for any buyout, because if you don't, that's when real disputes happen. And then the last phase is phase 13, which is insolvency winding up. And that's about, at some point, the entity that you have will cease to exist, the entity that runs your business. And that's just calling that. It doesn't have to be a bad thing. However, what I've seen is when businesses don't follow this sequence, then they often get to phase 13 a lot faster. And if they're not set up for litigation, then litigation hits and they get into phase 13 a lot faster. So phase 13 is that insolvency winding up piece. It's that piece about what happens at the end of a business. And if it's done correctly, then it's quite a pleasant experience. And it can be done quite well. And it's just, we had to put it in there as the final piece. So that's what phase 13 is. So there's my 13 other children.
Oh. Love it. I love hearing about it every time I think about it a little bit more deeply and a little bit more differently. So it's very, very cool. Quite often I'm in conversation with allied health business owners and they don't think they've got anything to sell. So they could be at different points in that life cycle. And they might have some team and doing well enough, but they can't imagine what is in that box that they would sell. What are your suggestions? What could I tell them next time?
Well, if they're listening to this, what you can tell them next time, it's their intellectual property. It's their database. It's how they do their work. There are thousands of businesses, tens of thousands of businesses around the world, and every one of them has a unique way of doing things. And that's really what you can sell, your unique value, and also your client base. Every business has clients, has customers. And if you've got employees, then that's what you're selling. If you can, you should make the business less reliant upon you that makes a business more valuable. I know you talk about this, and it's something that, you know, a journey that
make
I've been through.
Make yourself redundant.
The journey I've been through with my law firm is making yourself redundant, and that makes it a more valuable asset for you long term. That's what you sell. You sell the intellectual property, you sell the client base. And at the end of the day, that's what someone's going to buy. And, you know, in especially in those kind of practices, it could be that it's in a management buyout. You could have, you know, someone who's been working with you who might want to buy you out, and that they'll see the true value of the business and be able to justify paying you that money. And I don't know, I haven't seen it in your space, but in other spaces, there's been plenty of bigger businesses who have hoovered up smaller businesses. You know, it's going on in the legal industry right now, where small businesses, small law firms have been bought up by bigger ones who might want to buy client bases and intellectual property and merge them into what they're doing. That's something that's definitely a saleable business.
Yeah, it's certainly happening in allied health. I think a lot of listeners would be quite surprised if they knew about the transactions that were going on with practices wanting a different footprint in a certain neighbourhood, wanting to buy in team because it's so hard to recruit. There's some motivations there. So it's really, I'm delighted. I love hearing these stories because it's such a sign of maturity in our little part of the woods. But it's also exciting, and it also puts into context those 13 steps and potentially the 13 years and the missed lunches and the late nights and the work on weekends, that it is going to have a commercial value at some point in time.
Yeah, absolutely. It will have a commercial value. And at some point, you should have it set up so that if that does happen, that you can exit. And so just thinking, oh, I'll never be able to sell my business, sounds like a bit of an excuse to me. It sounds like someone who doesn't want to deal with the issue, and at the end of the day, they're the people who will regret it the biggest because they had the opportunity. So if you're listening to this, I don't mean to be mean, but he's being mean and real. And I said but, so you know.
Yeah.
But it is the truth. It is the truth, and it is at some point you're going to exit, and you're better off having everything in place so that you can maximize that return.
Yeah.
When you need to.
Let's run through exactly what intellectual property is, because I suspect people will be quite delighted with how much they already have but just hadn't considered it. So what's on your list for IP?
Well, IP is all of the intangible bits of your business that form what you do in your business. So by intangible, I mean the things that you can't feel and touch. That's your intellectual property. So the simple things are your name, your trademark, because we talk about trademarks, it's only a registered trademark, but every business has a trademark of some sort, even if it's just Jeremy Stretton, that's a trademark. Mm. Every business has a trademark, you just register it. The systems and processes of how you do what you do, your guides, your advertising material, all of these things are intellectual property that a business has and that people probably don't realize is of value. For me, the big thing is the systems and procedures. They are unique. Every person, as someone who's built a law firm, every person that comes in there has a different way that they want to do things. And so each of them has a unique way of managing their workload, but that goes into the value of the business that we've built because there's so many different ways of being right. And when someone doesn't know what to do, they can go in and see how someone else has done it and adopt that. And they've got the system and procedure to say, this is what they've got. I don't have it here with me, but I have a procedures manual that's like this thick of how we run our business. And that's not even the legal processes, but it's just how the business is operated, because that's a really valuable asset that most businesses don't have on just the day-to-day conduct of the business, let alone the legal work. So there's lots of intellectual property that business owners wouldn't even realize is intellectual property and something that they can protect. Yeah. Client list is another one. Your client list is intellectual property. It is something that is very, very valuable. And that is something that people don't realize because they're in their head all the time. They don't realize the value of that kind of intellectual property.
Does it drill right down to checklists and screening documents and letter formats and report formats and all of the documents associated with your team's performance, your development frameworks and all the documents through that. And
yep.
it goes right down to every single all piece of paper that you use, isn't it? Because you've developed that and it's part of the buzz of running your business.
That's exactly right. It's all your intellectual property. It's all part of what you do to run your business, and therefore it becomes the intellectual property for that business. So, yeah, all of that stuff, all those checklists, you know, they're all going to have a unique spin on them. They're all going to have a unique way of dealing with the particular client and the particular issue, and that has value. And that's worthwhile documenting, and it's worthwhile having in place and protecting for your business going forward.
So what do business owners, what process do they go through to A, identify all of this IP that they're sitting on and then get it protected?
Well, when you create something, so when I wrote this book, the way that I express, so the form of my expression, the words, are protected by copyright automatically. And that lasts, I think it's 50 years after I die. And that's mine. The concepts and the ideas behind this aren't protected. But the expression of the idea is. So that's copyright. So when you develop a checklist, the form of the checklist and how you do it is protected, but the ideas behind it aren't protected. And that's a really important distinction to understand. That's copyright. So copyright protects the expression of the idea, but not the idea itself. The actual idea itself is very, very difficult to protect. The main way to protect it and the main person who's going to take it from you are your team members if they leave. So that comes back to having your employment agreement properly drafted so that they can't take all that information. And if they do, that gives you a ability to go after them for breaching their agreement with you. So it's the expression of your idea. So if someone wanted to reproduce this book and sell it for themselves in word for word, that would be a breach of copyright. If they just wanted to take my 13 phases, I do have a trademark on the 13 phases for anyone listening. But if they do want to take it and reword it and do all that, then...
Good luck to them.
Yeah. Good luck to them.
See you in court.
There's enough people in the world. You know, there's enough businesses in the world. Well, but my point is that all of those checklists, all that stuff is automatically protected. And most of what you have will be automatically protected from when you actually generate that content. And people can't just go and take it. And if they do, then you can actually stop them from doing that if you want to spend the money with lawyers. But the main way to do that, though, is with your employees and good employment contracts that actually protect your intellectual property going forward. If you want to register a trademark for your business name, then you go through a process with IP Australia and you can register that. And as long as it's unique, you can have exclusive rights over that trademark. If you have a process that is really unique and is, you know, that no one else could possibly come up with, then you might be able to get a patent for that process. They are very, very difficult to get. I am not a patent attorney. I've never done a patent in my life. I know that they're difficult. and what I'd say is they're really for processes and ideas that are really, really unique. And so you can get those, you know, you can get a patent registered. Think about, you know, I mean, the classic example at the moment are the 3D printers. They're slowly coming off patent. So back in the 80s and 70s and 80s, 3D printers were developed and then no one was able to use them because patents had been in place for the last 10, 20, 30 years. And so now that those patents are slowly going and people have been able to produce 3D printers. That's the kind of thing that a patent protects. So very difficult for the kind of knowledge work that you and I do.
Service-related work. Very cool. So that makes it very unscary and very identifiable. And I guess it's then reaching out to the local friendly lawyer or your good selves to kind of run that audit and to decide what you're going to protect at a more official level. Is that about the extent of it?
Yeah. Essentially, what the best way to protect it is to have it all stored in one place. As I said, copyright's automatic. You don't register it anywhere. What you do though is you put it together as this is our intellectual property. You have it there, and that's a baseline of what you actually have, and you update it as you develop more, and that gives you that protection. So people can actually just do it themselves, but if they want that extra layer, then come and see a lawyer. Come and see us. Come and see your local business lawyer, and they can make sure that it's in a way that it can actually be protected going forward.
Yeah, cool. Good one. What are the main growing pains that you see, the legal growing pains that you see in SMEs?
I think we talked about it before. The biggest one I see is not reading agreements, not reading contracts, not understanding where people are coming from and just kind of flying by the seat of their pants. I think if people need to slow down and either get advice from their lawyer about what they're signing or read the thing themselves and get an understanding about what that actually is. And so I think that for me is probably the biggest one, is not reading contracts and not understanding what all of it actually means and not asking questions. It's very, you know, if you're signing a supply contract, it's very easy to go back and negotiate those terms. Any contract can be negotiated, whether it's, you know, with, it doesn't matter who it's with. I was going to say with Bunnings, but not really applicable for your audience, but you know, they negotiate, suppliers negotiate. And so if you're not comfortable with something, cross out a clause or get advice about it and take it out if you need to. That's the biggest thing that I see. And the second biggest thing I see is not understanding structure. So I talked about in phase two startup.
We haven't even talked about that yet.
No, we haven't even talked about it yet. But that's the next biggest thing is people who just go, just start a business. They go to a barbecue and they hear from their friend, they started their business this way. And so they go and start their business the same.
Sole trader, ABN, 24 hours later, good to go.
Yeah. And that might work for a while. But then if you grow anywhere or you have any problems, then sole traders can be a lot of issues and you should... You
know, a lot of tax.
A lot of tax, yeah. Well, if you're a sole trader, every single dollar that you earn, you're paying tax on. If you have a company or a trust, you can do things about that. You can divest the money through the entity in a much more tax-effective way. So, you know, getting into that is probably the second one that I see is just going and starting a business and just hoping it all works out, not getting any advice. And not getting advice from all of the stakeholders. You know, you should get advice from at least your accountant and your lawyer when you start up a business. At least.
Ideally in the same room, at the same meeting.
Yes. Sorry, I'm nodding my head for those listening. Have them in the same room. Have them on the same call. Use Zoom. Bring them together. I always insist that when I'm doing a startup that we talk to the client's accountant at the same time, because I have my idea about what should happen from a legal perspective. And the accountant will have their idea about what should happen from a tax perspective. And if you just go and get advice from one and then something changes, it's very easy for the other one to blame the consultant that wasn't in the room or the consultant that was in the room for the advice. So get everyone together and talking, and that will solve a lot of issues going forward.
And it can be quite difficult being the messenger, particularly when it's unfamiliar content and the other's asking you about what the other said and you, oh, wow.
Pick up the phone, you know, with these things, these smartphones these days, it's very easy to do a three-way call. Yeah, do it and get them on the phone together, get them talking. And you know what I've found, you know, that's been a big thing for me. And I've built great relationships with accountants and financial planners and coaches and various people because I'm involving them in the process. And so for any consultants out there, this is a way to build better relationships with other consultants and actually it's better for your business. So, yeah.
Yep. Great way to serve clients. So, reading agreements, slowing down, understanding, asking questions, negotiating contracts, and then the business structure, whether it's sole trader, company, trust. Yep. And I'm going to add on that to persist with your lawyer or accountant, that they draw it out and they just keep drawing it out and they keep answering questions until you have layers and layers of understanding, because it is foreign to most and it can take a while to kind of understand the pros and cons and how it all hangs together.
Well, remember that the lawyer has done 4 or 5 years of university education and, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years of practical experience, and they understand it like at the back of their hand. And so that, you know, it's okay to ask questions. It's okay to sit down and just keep on asking questions until you get it, or go away and then come back and with another question. Because we do lots of training. We do this. This is what we do all day, every day. It's not what other people do, and you just need to understand that and not feel silly for asking questions.
Yeah, and asking questions until you understand it.
Yes.
Not just asking questions and smiling and nodding. I eventually found an accountant that could draw. That was a mighty fine thing.
Well, circles and lines aren't really that hard.
So. No, they're not. Exclamation marks. Anyone can do them.
That's right.
All righty. Thank you so, so, so much. And huge kudos on your books in USA and the UK.
Thank you.
I look forward to the next editions coming out. And as I said, we'll reference this in the show notes because it's an absolute must read for Allied Health business owners. You can have the last say. What would you like to share before we close off on this one?
I didn't actually say this to you before recording, but I've actually put together a webpage for your listeners.
Oh, beautiful.
At Business Legal Lifecycle /private, we'll just call it that, so that's nice for people to go to. And on that, they can get a copy of Chapter 2 Startup, because I think it's that important.
Yeah, it's a good...
If they want to get a copy of the whole book, then there'll be a link on there too. And I do that because that's the pay for it. But Chapter 2 is because I think it's really, really important that people understand that and understand the concepts in that. And the final thing that's on that page is a 50% discount to do our BLL test. So we haven't even talked about that, but I have and you've done this test, Kathy, an online test that people can take where they can do, it's 30 questions, it takes about 10 minutes, and that helps them to see the blind spots in their business, what they're missing from a legal perspective. So as a thank you for having me on the show, your listeners, if they jump on there and do that, there's a code and coupon code and all the rest of it on that page, then they can do the BLL test for 50% off, and that will help them with their business. And if they want to, they can reach out to me and I can help them on implementing that in their business as well.
Yeah. And it's a really good process, that questionnaire. It's not hard. You don't have to study or anything. Like it's about you and the business rather than the legalese stuff around it. So wow, that's really cool. That's a really good surprise. Thank you.
That's right.
All righty. So thank you, Jeremy. Make sure we'll get you back in sooner than the last time you're in, which is like 90 episodes ago, and you can share up what you're up to next, and we can get into some more meaty small business topics.
Thanks so much for having me.
See ya. Thank you.
Bye.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode of the Private Practice Made Perfect podcast. For show notes and other resources, please visit practicemadeperfectpodcast.com. While you are there, you can subscribe for future episodes and continue your business adventure with me. And please be sure to share this and other episodes with your friends and colleagues.